If you run a business large or small, get ready to take a lot of notes, because it's time for a solid hour of business insights and strategies for success on Mind Your Business. Host Yitzhak Saflis is off this week, and filling in for him is Bill O'Reilly, a partner at the November Team, a New York-based communications firm.
Thanks for tuning in to Mind Your Business, the weekly radio show for business and marketing insights. Every Sunday from 11 p.m. to midnight on 77 WABC Radio, I'm guest host Bill O'Reilly of the November Team. Your regular host, Yitzhak Saflis of Bottom Line Marketing, will be back next week. I've got to say, it's been a lot of fun to guest host for Yitzhak. He was very, very nice to allow me to do it. It's been tons of fun. I met him during a political race some years back when a guy named Congressman Bob Turner was first running for election. And Yitzhak is just a marketing genius and really one of the true wonderful guys in New York. If you ever need marketing type advice or things, look up his company, Bottom Line Marketing, which is bottomlinemg.com. My company use them for website work. We use them for all kinds of stuff. But Yitzhak, thank you for this opportunity, and be well. Look forward to hearing you next week. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about the political industry. We've talked about different industries, sports last week, and we want to talk about politics today, which is near and dear to me. I work at a political communications shop called the November Team, which you can look up also, novemberteam.com. But the industry itself is a really fascinating one, and we've got some great guests on today. The first person we have we're really, really lucky to have him on, is Jim McLaughlin of McLaughlin & Associates. McLaughlin & Associates is one of the premier pollsters and survey takers internationally. We have Jim McLaughlin on from McLaughlin & Associates. Jim, welcome to Mind Your Business. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, and it's great to be on the show, Bill.
Yeah, Jim, we've obviously worked together before, and a lot of people probably know your name. But if you can, you know, let listeners know kind of what you do and what your firm does, because you do it everywhere. I know you do it, you know, from all across the U.S. and the Middle East and elsewhere. If you could just give us a recap.
Yeah, we're your most known for being your friendly neighborhood pollster. And as I like to tell people, Bill, you know, we do everything from, you know, your local city council race, and that's how I grew up doing politics myself in Rockland County and Clarkstown, New York, working on local campaigns there. And now, as you know, we do presidential races. You know, I've been fortunate enough in the past to work for people like Bob Dole, and I'm involved in this presidential race right now working on Bobby Jindal's Super PAC. But we also even do stuff internationally. We've done some work in Canada, working for Stephen Harper's on some of his races up there, and we've also done work for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Likud party in Israel, and it's a lot of fun, you know. And it's funny, we do corporate and political work, and don't tell my corporate clients, but I still love the political stuff, and it's a lot of fun these days. And we do the polling, and we do the focus groups, and we help candidates with messaging, and we help them with their targeting and their data analytics and all that other kind of good stuff. And what a lot of times is, we're literally applying things that you might do in business to political campaigns to help our candidates get elected.
And probably vice versa. I mean, I've worked in a couple of corporate firms over the years that were just staffed with political people because I guess the work ethic and the training is good. Jim, I do a column a couple of days a week for Newsday, and I've got one on this topic coming out in AM New York tomorrow. And I've noticed in the past year especially, and I'm not sure if it has to do with Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders or what it is, but the comment sections are just lighting up where people just hate politics.
Yep.
Why do you think that is now? Why is everyone so down on the entire industry?
That's you know what? It's interesting because and this has been going on since 2004, I tell people. And you've basically had and it's gotten worse and worse every year since then. The last time we really had status quo elections where folks were saying, yeah, we like the folks in charge, we like the folks in power, they're the ones, you know, we want the ones with experience, that was back in 2004 when basically during George Bush's re-election. Since then, because, you know, the economy, there's a perception the economy's been getting worse and worse, or, you know, and then it's kind of stable off, but people still don't feel great about the economy. And that was probably at its worst, which you had happen, you know, when you had the financial collapse in September of 2008, and things, you saw them with the economy get really bad. There was a lot of war fatigue, you know, in terms of the Iraq war and even the Afghan war to some extent. And there's a real sense right now that the political system is broken, and people don't like politics. And that's why you have, you know, that's why you have basically, whether it's the Republican primary right now, where probably the top three leading candidates, Trump and Carly Fiorina and Ben Carson, have never been elected to anything before. And one of the dirty little secrets on the Democratic side is right now Bernie Sanders would probably beat Hillary Clinton in both Iowa and New Hampshire right now. When you're Hillary Clinton and you're polling in the low 30s in the Iowa caucuses in New Hampshire, you're probably going to lose. And Bernie Sanders is viewed as the outsider. There's a sense our economic system isn't as working as well as it used to be. People don't feel secure about the economy. And there's also a real sense, you know, when it comes to national security, and I think that issue in a lot of ways has really, you know, been on the back burner over the last few years. But voters sense it, that it's still an important issue, and things like terrorism right now, there's a lot of insecurity among voters. And, you know, and I think, quite honestly, they're right. They're taking it out on the politicians right now because they want people to lead and they want to see some successes out there.
Yeah, the funny thing is that Bernie Sanders has been in office for, what, a couple hundred years now?
I
think since Madison. But, I mean, how does somebody keep that outsider feel while being in for so long? It's a good trick.
Yeah, and look, you know what? People want performance. And they want results. You know, a guy who you and I work for, Rob Astorino in Westchester, you know, Rob is a Republican who wins in a 2-1 Democratic county. Why does he win? Because he's been successful. He's either cut taxes or held the line on taxes every year he's been in office. And you and I know that's the number one issue in Westchester right now. He understands those pocketbook economic concerns. You know, he's been doing spending reforms there. They actually spend less than when he first took office. And you see that in pockets and with, you know, political figures across the country. One of Rob's great successes is he's a regular guy. He's a guy who came from business. And he's taken those business principles and he's applied them to local government. And those are the folks that, in a lot of ways, are the ones that are most successful right now. The ones that are taken, you know, they're not part of the same old establishment political crowd. And again, you see it, you know, probably in somebody like Bill de Blasio, who, you know, hasn't been successful. I mean, the guy was a former political consultant, and you and I as political consultants, I don't know if I'd ever recommend that to be somebody who actually holds office.
Yeah.
And you see somebody who may have, you know, some things that may have been working when he was a political operative are not the right thing to do as mayor.
You know, right now there's one declared candidate, I guess, for the mayoral race, but you know, Chuck Schumer is up for re-election next year. There's no candidate for that race. Republican.
Do you want to run against Schumer? I'll support you.
I don't think so. You just said. but like, what does it take if you could just peel back the curtain a little bit for listeners, like, or even if you wanted to run for dog catcher or for, you know, or for, you know, sheriff or for city council, whatever it might be, what does it take to actually get into a race? Like, what are the components of a campaign that the average Joe Q citizen would need to know before taking that jump?
That's a great question. And I always tell people, run your campaigns the way you would your own little small business. Start out as lean and mean as possible. You know, and I tell them, don't get big overheads because literally, you know, 70% of your campaign budget, 70% plus, should go into what I call direct voter contact. Things that you're doing in the campaign to actually persuade voters. And that's always one of the great challenges that we have running campaigns in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area, is it's so darn expensive. We live in the most expensive media market in America.
And Jim, what are those things, those direct voter contacts?
Yep, it's things like direct mail. It's things like, even though people are telling you things like television aren't as effective as they used to be, TV is still as good of a communication as there is to get, you know, a message out there. You want to do earned media. I mean, you know, look, you know, we're on ABC Radio, and I tell folks all the time, it's one of the best, you know, you've got people that listen to WABC Radio in New York. They are what we call the high information voters. They're people that are looking to get their news, their talk, their information. You want to get those earned media opportunities. We love it whenever one of our candidates can get on a WABC Radio. You want to do digital media. And you know, back in the old days, it used to be, okay, let's put up the one television ad and, you know, everybody would, you know, 1,000 points meant kind of everybody was going to see it. But now it's almost an all of the above strategy. You want to do that TV. You want to do the radio. You want to do the digital. You want to do the mail. Plus, you want to do your grassroots activities. So it's what you're seeing is a big diversity in communications now. And I see it with my corporate clients, with my commercial clients, as well as I see it with my political clients.
You know, just blows me away, Jim, and most listeners probably don't know this, but you could be watching All in the Family, just say, or whatever the current show might be.
Yep.
And I could be watching the same show, and you're seeing a different ad than I am based on your party registration.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit to that and how your industry, the polling side in particular, has to deal with that? I mean, it's a constantly shifting environment.
Yep. That's one of the beautiful things that's going on right now. And, you know, we're seeing pre-rolls and the digital ads more and more. And, you know, we're able to talk to people now on their laptops and on their computers right now. And you have a choice, and you can target it. Like, for instance, you know, we did some digital and we did some pre-roll back when in the Bob Turner's race when he had his big upset where, you know, we were running ads where, you know, you don't want to, we didn't have the ability to buy broadcast television in New York City. So what we were able to do was target folks specifically within that congressional district. And, you know, Lord knows when they cut up these congressional districts, they don't necessarily think of political folks or they think of politicians in terms of how they can do their targeting. But we can make sure that, you know, through that digital, that we're talking to people that are just specifically in that congressional district or even at the local level, you know, state senate district. And you might have a different message that you might want to use with older women versus younger men. And we can do it by issue. Younger men may be more interested in things like the economy and, you know, taxes, et cetera, whereas an older woman may care more about things like health care. And you can specifically target ads to those folks based off of that. And that's one of the fun, interesting things that you can do now.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about other ways? I mean, there were, you know, traditional breakdowns of people by, you know, gender, age, political party, that type of thing. But
yeah.
But it's become so, I don't know if bifurcated is the word, it's, you know, multifurcated, I guess. Like, can you talk about some of the category breakdowns that are now possible?
Yep. Oh, and no question about it is, again, it's, you know, people say, okay, and you see this a lot of times with Republican candidates. Well, they'll tell you, oh, we have a gender gap. And you'll say, okay, well, yeah, there's a gender gap there, but many times there's married women, many times, especially married women with children, are more likely to vote for Republicans. And you might have, say, a married woman with children who lives in the suburbs that you want to look at. Those are the kinds of things you can do. And again, men aren't monolithic. Women aren't monolithic. You might say, you know, we not only have to do well with women, with kids in the suburbs, you know, in the certain, we can even break it down, you know, by zip codes, et cetera, and do that kind of targeting and get a message to them. Because, you know, if you're a Republican and you're trying to win in a place like New York, New Jersey, or Connecticut, you've got to not just win a majority, but probably get about 60% plus if you're, you know, trying to get that woman that has a child that lives in the suburbs, et cetera. And there's a lot of different ways we can go and we can contact them now with, and not just your traditional television ad that most people are going to see.
You know, I remember sitting on the couch of a girlfriend's parents' house in 1984. when that, which I barely remember, but I remember because the Morning in America ad popped up for the first time, or the first time I had seen it. And they were a Democratic household. I was trying to knuckle back the tears, you know, because I thought it was just one, to me, probably the best political ad I've ever seen.
Yep.
But there was something I thought special about the entire nation seeing one thing at once. And that ad ran in 50 states. It was a national thing, which doesn't happen anymore. Do you think we lose something with all the segmentation?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting, you know, and it tells you how presidential campaigns have changed because, and you know what, you would see those ads on broadcast television and whatnot back then. But now, and you're right, there was basically about 8, 9, 10 states last time where most of those ads were being run. And by the way, they were a lot more negative than the ads that, you know, the Morning in America campaign was running in 84.
Yeah, the Obama ads in the re-election were, what was it, like 98% negative?
90-plus percent.
Yeah,
I don't know exactly what it was, but it was extremely high, the ads, you know, in terms of the negative nature
and
of
they
the
worked.
Ads.
Yeah.
And you're exactly right. And what was happening was in states, in these key swing states like Ohio and North Carolina and Florida and Virginia, et cetera, they were seeing them for months. You know, basically ads that were saying, hey, Mitt Romney's going to outsource your job. He's going to cut your Social Security. He's going to cut your health care, et cetera. Those kinds of ads. And, you know, that's where they were targeted. And I think there is something to be said about that now where you don't have, you know, really in New York, you know, we probably don't love the political ads, but in the New York, Connecticut, New Jersey ads, we don't see those ads in the presidential races because New York, quite honestly, hasn't been competitive in a presidential election since about 1988.
Yeah.
So it has changed from that standpoint, and we really don't have the national election that we used to because of the Electoral College.
I remember sitting in a focus group about 12 or 15 years ago, and we were running ads by this group, different types. And we ran some, you know, beautiful, uplifting anthem ads, I guess they're called. and people loved them. And then we ran some negative spots, and people said they hated them. And then we went back and tested them for recollection, and all they remembered was the negative.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it's what works. Why do you think that is? I mean, you understand mass psychology better than anyone I know.
You know,
why do you think that is?
One of my favorite books that I still read every once in a while, I pull it out, is Ogilvy on Advertising. And one of the things he says in an ad is when you watch that ad, you should say to yourself, what is the message behind that ad? And that's what we do in a lot of the times, the focus groups, because most of the time they'll tell you they don't like the negative ads. But you want to ask them, the more important question is, what is the message behind the ad? If they're getting the message that so-and-so cut health care or he's bad for women or he or she is, you know, knows how to create jobs and make the economy better, that's what you want to make sure that they're getting through with the ad. Not necessarily whether they want to think it's a negative ad that they don't like, but what's the message behind the ad? And quite honestly, folks get the messages behind the negative ads. And the reason why you're going to see so many negative ads, because, again, the difference was Ronald Reagan ran a Morning in America campaign back in 1984, and the reason why he ran that campaign was because 70% plus of the electorate said the country was moving in the right direction. And right now, you've got nearly two-thirds of voters say the country's off on the wrong track.
I just looked at that number this morning. Yeah, it was 64.8 or something, the polling average. Just incredible. And it's been sitting there for about 8 years.
And it's been higher. It's basically been like that, been almost that bad. It got better for Obama when he was doing the forward stuff, and it was almost at about, it was about 48% right direction right before Election Day. And that's one of the reasons why he won. You know, you had Sandy and, you know, he was doing a bunch of bipartisan stuff then and saying, hey, things were getting a little better. Bill Clinton was telling him the economy was getting a little bit better. But you're right. For the most part, since the collapse of the, since the financial collapse in September of 2008, it's been about 60% plus telling you the country's off on the wrong track.
You know, that old conversation is that, you know, people hate the Congress, which I think is at about 8% approval.
Yep.
But they vote for their congressman or congresswoman.
Yeah.
Why do incumbents almost always win?
They do, but you've been seeing it, you know, more and more where incumbency isn't what it used to be. And again, a lot of it is, quite honestly, redistricting. And I don't want to get too far down in the weeds on that, but a lot of these congressional races are decided, and even we see it at the local level, you know, with the assembly races and with the state senate races. You know, these politicians, for all intents and purposes, in a lot of ways, they help the incumbents with redistricting, and the party in charge especially will usually help incumbents in terms of redistricting. But that's why you see a lot of there's been some changes and whatnot in terms of, you know, the House and the Senate. Because, I mean, think about it. You know, back in 04, the Republicans controlled it. But then in 06, 08, the Democrats took control. A lot of incumbent Republicans lost. And then because there was a perception in 2010 that, you know, Obama had gone too far to the left, then you had a bunch of Republicans. The Republicans took control of the House and the Senate again. So you're seeing some more change, but one of the big reasons for it, quite honestly, it's redistricting. You know, they try to do what they can to help their incumbent members.
And I guess they also get, you know, mail and free media coverage.
Yeah.
You know, the media. I mean, one of my favorite things to do is to challenge incumbents. I find it just professionally much more challenging, and it's frankly more fun.
Yep.
You can be a little bit loose. You can move when you shoot, you know.
Yep.
And what advice would you give to anyone out there who might, on any part of the aisle, any side of the aisle, that might be looking to challenge an incumbent? How do you do that?
Yep. You know, and again, you hate to say this, and one of the first things you want to do, you want to make sure you can have enough money, have the resources in order to be competitive. Now, the interesting part is you don't need as much money. You know, I mean, and again, you look at the presidential race, you know, Jeb Bush right now, who I actually have a lot of respect for and I think was a very good governor in Florida, Jeb Bush is polling at around, you know, 5-6% right now in Iowa, and he's got all the money in the world. And Hillary Clinton, she's got a ton of money, and she's basically losing to Bernie Sanders in Iowa and New Hampshire right now. But you do need to make sure that you have enough money to be able to get a message through, even though you don't have the, you know, even though you don't need to have as much in terms of resources. The other thing that you want to do, you got to have a message. You got to have a reason. And this is something I think people overlook. You want to make sure, like, and again, I'm going to use Rob Astorino as an example. He had a message when he first ran, and when he beat Andy Spano, he was going to change things. He was going to reform things. He was going to make Westchester County more affordable, and that's what you needed. And you can say whatever we want about Donald Trump, but right now Donald Trump has a message. You know, it's make America great again. Everybody, even though he stole that from the Reagan campaign and he stole it from Rob Astorino.
Let's make New York great again, exactly.
Yep. You know, you got to have a message. And I think that's really, really important because you got to give people strong, compelling reasons to vote for you. Because I think that one of the big mistakes politicians make, quite honestly, is they insult the intelligence of the electorate. People are a lot smarter than politicians give them credit for. And they know right now. That's why they're dissatisfied. They know our economy is not what it should be. They know our national security isn't what it needs to be. They know our government is broken right now, and they're looking for people that can fix it. So I think you need to make sure you have the resources. I think you need to make sure you have a message. And I think the third thing is, you got to be willing to work hard, because you and I know. I always tell, you know, we deal with a lot of folks, a lot of guys, a lot of gals that are successful in business, and I always tell them, doing the business thing is easy. Doing the political thing is probably as hard and as a humbling thing as you'll ever do in your life. And a lot of times after the campaign, they tell me I was right about that.
Yeah, Jim, something I've noticed over the years, and I've never asked you about it offline, is it seems that in campaigns, numbers move like in flocks. Like, it's not an incremental thing.
Yep.
If, you know, someone could be 8 points down 2 weeks before an election, it doesn't normally go 8-7-6-5-4.
Yep.
It goes 8-even, 8-up.
Yep.
What's that about?
You know what it is? It's like anything else, momentum. Momentum is hugely important in politics and business, and we see like products get momentum, like the Apple iPhone, you know, gets momentum, and it becomes like the cool kind of in thing to do.
Word of mouth, just
yeah. I think it's all the above. It's word of mouth. It's digital now. All that stuff tends to matter. And again, you see it in politics. Momentum is something that's hugely important. You know, for a while there, you know, Donald Trump had a lot of the momentum, whether we like it or not. He had the momentum. Now you're seeing some of the momentum might be going to, you know, Cauley Fiorina or Ben Carson or Marco Rubio. There's momentum, whether it's in politics or whether it's in business or whether it's in your local sporting event. It is a hugely and hugely important thing. And you're right. A lot of times these things tend to go in waves.
And you, I guess the timing of the momentum is so important, too. I mean, if you peak too early, you know, you got to do it at just the right time. You know, Bob Turner took off. He had a special election, and he was able to, you know, stay up there for a long time, which was nice.
Yeah, and you talk about momentum. On this date 4 years ago in Ohio and nationally, that were ahead in the Republican nomination for president, the people that were ahead were Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann.
Yeah.
And then, by the way, a few weeks later, Herman Cain was ahead in November. And so we see how things change and how the momentum changes very carefully. And you're going to see a lot of swings and a lot of shifts in the upcoming presidential campaign. And you're going to see it, quite honestly, in the other elections leading up to 2016.
You're listening to Mind Your Business on WABC. We have on Jim McLaughlin from McLaughlin & Associates. Jim, if I could ask one final question. Could you do just a brief handicap of how you see the presidential race? I know it's kind of a loaded question, but
I am going to give it because I get asked every day. And again, I'm biased on this. I'm helping out Bobby Jindal Super PAC. But I will tell you this. I think it's totally wide open, and I really believe that. You know, and again, you see it with, you know, folks like Jeb Bush, who, again, I have a lot of respect for, is not doing well right now in the presidential election because they're looking for that outsider. They're looking for that reformer. And I think we're looking at something we've never seen before right now. There's 15 candidates. A guy like Rick Perry, who had a lot of money, a lot of momentum last time we were talking about it, and actually raised quite a bit of money this time, he's already dropped out. That's what a competitive field this is. And the thing is, I love the most about the Republican field right now, all the diversity, all the excitement, all the energy right now is on the Republican side. And I really, really believe that. I mean, think about it. Who would have thought in two debates already so far, they're the highest rated programs in the history of cable television. We've gotten over 25 million people that claim that they were watching each debate.
Yeah, 50 million. Yeah, exactly.
It's incredible that, you know, you have 25 million people that are telling you they've actually shown. But I think it's very fluid. I think things are going to change, and I think it's going to be really, really interesting. And you know what, Bill? Campaigns, marketing, having the ability to sell oneself and one's ideas, it's going to be hugely important in this election.
Yep, I think absolutely. Jim, thank you so much. Jim McLaughlin of McLaughlin Associates. Jim, thanks for all your insights. I could listen to them for about a day and a half.
Thank you. No, it's always a pleasure, Bill, and you're the best. You're the best communications guy in New York.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks.
Talk to you. Okay, bye.
Your company website is crucial to your success. Providing information about your services and programs, it has to deliver just the right message, the right way, to make customers excited about what you offer and interested in working with you. Online, you have to be on the money to make the money. So go with the best. Website with Brains. Their experienced team will plan, write, design, and program a winning website that combines simplicity and flexibility with powerful features that will make you the king of content marketers, and they make it so easy. All of their websites are made with an easy, user-friendly interface. Website with Brains will have your new website up and running within 4 to 6 weeks. Take control of your online marketing today. Call Website with Brains for a free consultation and see how they can improve your online presence. 1-800-WEB-9018. That's 1-800-WEB-9018. Or visit them online at websitewithbrains.com.
Welcome back to Mind Your Business on 77 WABC. I'm guest host Bill O'Reilly. I'm filling in for Yitzhak Saflis from Bottom Line Marketing. We've been talking politics. We just spoke with Jim McLaughlin of McLaughlin & Associates. And now we're going to be joined by two great and senior seasoned political consultants in New York. Dave Catalfimo from Park Strategies, and Jessica Proud, who also happens to be my business partner at the November team. Jess and Dave, welcome to Mind Your Business.
Thanks for having us.
You know, I was,
one of us is seasoned and one of us is senior. Just, I think I'm the senior one.
Just plain old, right? You know, I was talking to Jim, and I was talking about comments on columns that I do these days for Newsday and for AM New York. And the comment section is pretty clear. If you want to hear people being very much on message, it's that they hate politics, they hate politicians, they hate the industry, they hate anyone who works in it. What do you think that's about? Do you guys have the same sense?
I think it's obvious when you take a look at what's going on in the national polling with folks like Ben Carson and Donald Trump and Carly Fiorina leading the pack. You see a real surge among outsiders, folks who don't have any political background, who aren't part of the system, and they're obviously resonating with voters right now. Anyways, they are. And with voters who clearly are fed up and angry with some aspect of what they see going on either in the economy or what they see going on in Washington. And, you know, to a large extent, they got a legitimate gripe.
Go ahead, Dave. I'm sorry.
No, you look at what's going on in Washington, and for Republicans at least, especially, they went ahead and they elected a Republican Congress, they have Republican control, and Republicans promised a whole bunch of stuff that they're going to do, and thus far have been unable to deliver on that, and so I think there's a lot of resentment about that.
Do you think that's a little bit of a reflection of just where the country is historically? I mean, we had this great boom following the Second World War. There was very little competition out there. Europe was devastated. Asia was devastated. And we kind of ruled the roost for a while. Do you think it's just a reflection of the U.S. in a very different world and people are turning on politicians? Or do you think it's the politicians themselves? What do you think, Jess?
Well, just to expound on what Dave was saying also, I think the policy is certainly a huge piece of it. But I also think that, you know, people are just fed up with the whole cynical system of the way campaigns are run now. And I think, you know, look, we're as consultants, that's considered a dirty word now, but you have a lot of super PAC money coming in. And I think that's why, you know, you see people kind of responding to someone like Trump or Bernie Sanders because of the money in the system. And they look at, you know, they look at the whole system and they feel like it's rigged from the beginning. They feel like it's, you know, it's very negative and, you know, good people that have the right intentions don't get into politics anymore. So I think that people feel like the whole system has gotten away from what it was intended to be and that you have it controlled by just, you know, consultants looking to make money and candidates and special interests that are in it for themselves. So I think the policy is certainly a huge part of that. But I think it's also just the way campaigns are run today. It has people feeling, you know, very turned off and they look at it very distastefully.
But I mean, campaigns are run the way they are for a reason. I mean, people speak in
right.
And candidates speak in sound bites because that's what the media wants to hear. But the media is just reflecting what people want to hear. I mean, there's a reason why there's not policy on the air. I mean, we could all turn on PBS and watch a long show about issue X, Y, or Z. But people really want the quick hits. I mean, can you really blame the political industry for giving people what they want? To a large degree, reflects the voter.
Totally. I mean, how many times do we lament when reporters don't cover serious policy proposals that we put out on behalf of candidates? They all want to talk about processy questions, you know, who's in the lead in the horse race and what the latest polls show. Certainly, the game is played by what the voter demand, and you know Trump is a perfect example of that.
And, I mean, Dave, you're a messaging guy. You're a great messaging guy. Like, what advice do you give to your candidates?
Well, I mean, two comments on that. I think one is that if you look at say the coverage of Donald Trump, I mean, I believe like maybe 2 weeks ago, I read a story where CNN had alone 2,000 stories on Donald Trump, 2,000. Okay, now that's from somebody who already has probably 100% name ID. So Donald Trump isn't spending money on political advertising. He's not spending money on campaign commercials or radio commercials or print or mail or anything. He doesn't need to because the media is delivering that message for him. So I think I tend to disagree that I think that there is a little bit more responsibility in the media to actually do something that's fairly responsible, and that they're breathless, you know, sort of following of candidly idiotic people that are never going to be president. And I'll limit that to Donald Trump right now, you know, is a disservice to the voters. It's great for ratings. It's great for TV. It's great for them selling commercials, but it's not doing jack for the voter who needs to make a serious decision. And ultimately they will. I don't think anybody, does anybody on this call think that Donald Trump's going to be president of the United States?
No, but at the same extent, it's what people want to tune into. I mean, you had 24 million and 26 million people watch those debates because probably Donald Trump, I mean, very certainly Donald Trump was in those debates. I mean, people kind of wanted to see the freak show. You know, they wanted to see what he might say. And you know, there is that instinct in the viewership. And so, you know, the media knows that, you know, so they certainly play to it. But you're right, Dave, obviously there's a lot lost. And, you know, there's a reason why there's a low information voter. I suppose. But Dave, how do you teach, if we could just peel back the curtain, I asked Jim to do the same thing for listeners who have a peripheral interest in politics, might, you know, watch it on the news or in the newspaper, but don't really understand the industry. What are the components of a political race? Like, if you had somebody who decided to jump into a race, what do you need to do? What positions need to be filled? Like, what drives a race? Jess, why don't you take a crack at it?
Oh, sure. I mean, you have to kind of set it up like a business. I mean, it's an organization that requires a lot of different talents, and everyone needs to be, you know, fulfilling their role in order for a campaign to go smoothly. And then even then, sometimes, you know, you can hit the perfect storm and it still doesn't turn out the way you want to. But it is an expensive endeavor, just on the operational side. You know, you need someone, you need a campaign manager. A lot of campaigns often have consultants. They'll have a general consultant, a paid media consultant, the communication side, which the three of us do. And then you have, you know, the people underneath. Like, you have your chiefs and then you have your Indians, and you need the people going out into the field, knocking on doors, making phone calls, you know, communicating with opinion leaders. It's a whole polling. There's so many different roles that you need to fill. And so it really requires a lot of organization right up front.
It also seems to go year-round now. I mean, it used to be a seasonal thing, but now it's constant. Dave, you've been working in politics for a long time. Have you seen it change a great deal because of technology or because of strategies? Like, how have you seen it shift in your professional career?
Yeah, I think on both levels. I think the advent of social media and technology has really allowed us to reach out to voters, both our base voters and new voters, in a way that we probably don't even fully comprehend yet. I mean, they learn and adopt new strategies to take advantage of these social media channels. And then, you know, beyond that, sort of the industry of the whole campaign world has changed from the point of view as we look at sort of what's going on in the media world with the fractionalization of media. It used to be you'd buy three networks. Now you have networks and cable and TiVo and Sirius. And, you know, I mean, just the fractionalization of the audience has made it much more sort of opportunistic in some ways, but also much more challenging to target audiences with messages that whether you're selling a candidate or whether you're selling a bar of soap.
Jim was talking about that a little bit. I should have mentioned before to listeners that among many other roles that you've had, you were the communications director for Governor Pataki for 12 years. Is that right, David? Or about 10?
No, just for a couple at the very end. But, you know, it was at that time really that social media was becoming, was starting to explode, and, you know, really, you know, just trying to grasp that and understand it and to use the different channels is, again, it's a challenge even still today, as it's constantly sort of evolving. And you know, like any sort of business, like Jess was saying, you're trying to keep up with it and take advantage of it.
I don't really like that splintering of the messages that much. Just professionally, I always found that I wanted to sit down and write the great ad that would sway, or write the great speech or the great news release or opinion piece that would sway the masses. And now it's broken into so many different pieces that you're writing 60 of them. You know, and you're going after eight people. You know, it's like really, really small. You know, Jim and I talked about how we could both be watching the same television program but seeing different ads based on your income or your political party, that type of thing. Do you see this? Is there any way that that's going to stop, or do you just think it keeps splintering as technology gets more sophisticated?
It's going to keep getting more refined and keep getting more self-selected. I mean, we're now able to basically self-select on both the entertainment and the news that we want. So, you know, and we're also able to screen out commercials. I watched, you know, the head of TiVo yesterday talking about you can go on TiVo now and basically select a season of almost any show, and they'll put it together for you, and you can run through it without looking at commercials.
Yeah.
You know, it's incredible, really.
It is an interesting point that you make, though, Bill, is that, you know, as professionals, is it more effective to try to create a message that unites everyone and that something someone can rally around and be inspired by, or do you try to target something specific to what resonates with that individual? I mean, I feel like it's been a long time since you've seen a political candidate really inspire, you know, like a Reagan, really inspire and unite everybody around. I guess you could say Obama did that
early on.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been the push for 51% for a long time. That was certainly kind of the Rovian strategy. Was you do the math and try and get over the top. But you did see. I mean, something that President Obama did well initially was he did go after 50 states. I mean, they went with a national strategy. But I agree with you, Dave. Though I don't see how it stops happening. When you can, you know, you surf the internet on your phone and the thing that you looked at is following you on television, on wherever you go, you know, they're pushing an ad for what you were just looking at. I don't know how that doesn't boil down into politics and stay there. It's a tough thing. Why do you guys think incumbents win so often? Jim and I talked a little bit about that, but the stat was always in New York, it was around 98% of state officials would be reelected. It's probably a little bit less now. What are those advantages that keep them in office?
Well, the single biggest one is gerrymandering, which, you know, basically they draw districts which are increasingly partisan and increasingly of one party or another, which is, you know, affected our politics as a whole, but obviously also ensures high reelection rates for incumbents. I think that's the first and foremost among the reasons why incumbents get returned. But obviously there's advantages to being an incumbent from the point of view of being able to have a consistent message that lasts throughout the cycle of your incumbency, being able to deliver sort of on the civic side and of the public service side, to be able to deliver on campaign promises or on public policy needs.
Yep.
That obviously creates opportunities for voters to attach to you and stay with you.
Yeah, Jess,
And I think also, you know, certainly from a fundraising perspective, I mean, so much of the political money that flows into the system now is from people that have, you know, dependency upon government in some form or another, whether it's they're regulated by them or they receive resources from them. So, you know, to my earlier point about people sort of looking at the system as a little bit rigged, you know, as an incumbent, you have a greater ability to raise money and to prevent your challenger from being able to raise money. A lot of times you can ice money out from potential donors. And, you know, I think a little bit of it is, you know, sometimes I think people go with the devil they know versus the one they don't. You know, it's always, I think the electorate has to feel a compelling reason to make a change sometimes. Otherwise, you know, they may not be 100% happy with you, but they know what they're getting. So I think that factors into it sometimes as well.
Jess, you just touched on a very, very important point, and I think one that's little discussed. You said that candidates can have their funding iced out. What did you mean by that?
Well, as an incumbent, you know, there's a certain amount of money. You can raise small dollars from the average voter. But then, you know, you have your sort of, you know, regular political donors, people that give regularly to politicians on both sides of the aisle, and they usually give depending on who's in power. So if they have interest before whatever government body that person is running for, you know, if I'm the governor, I'm going to call up and say, hey, don't give to the guy running against me if you want this project to go through. Now, that's not necessarily legal to say it exactly that way, but it's kind of a wink, wink, nod, nod, and everyone gets how the system works.
It's funny, the bigger government gets and the more tentacles are out there, it just touches more and more industries and more constituencies that can then donate money. So it's a pretty important point, I think, that you're making there. Dave, what would you say to somebody thinking of running, who may never have considered running, small office, big office, whatever it is? There's plenty of incumbents out there that have no opponents. How do you start? Like, what do you do? I'm going to run. What do you do?
Well, I think first and foremost, you need to do a gut check and see if you're up to the challenge of it. It's a business like no other, in that it requires sort of a 24/7 commitment for a limited duration, but a longer and longer duration. It also requires sort of the fortitude to go ask strangers for money, to meet strangers and sell them on your ideas, and obviously to raise the resources that would make you competitive. And all of those things are incredibly important and incredibly challenging. So I'd say first and foremost, you need to do a gut check.
Yeah, I remember.
I would say also you need like one person that you can really trust that you can talk to about things, like whether it's a long time, a lifelong friend or someone that you've known throughout your business career, whatever industry you're in, someone that like a real confidant. And I think a lot of successful politicians, like sometimes we use the term in the business called a rabbi, and you need someone that you can just bounce things off of. And when things get rough, someone that's going to pick you up and get you through it. And I think it's really important to have somebody like that. And a lot of the successful candidates have someone that they keep with them throughout their entire career.
I think it's amazing also once people cross that threshold, how quickly they become labeled. I remember years ago working with a young woman with a pretty extraordinary resume in Westchester County who was so tired of the high property taxes and so tired of that eating into her household budget that she decided to run. And she was a family friend, and she asked me to go out with her to a train station the first morning, and she printed up palm cards with the picture on it and her basic positions. And this was just, average, Jane Q. citizen, stepped onto the platform and said good morning to the first person, and the person rolled her eyes and said, oh, God, not another politician. And, here was the regular citizen jumping in, and that's what you're faced with. There's so much negativity in politics. Why do you think that is, and why do you think negative campaigning works so well, Dave?
That's a very good question. I understand why there's a lot of negativity, and that's because people are frustrated with both the results of their government and sort of, I think for the first time in quite a while, Americans look at their future and it's not as sure as it has been. Or it's not as promising as maybe it once was. And so I think that creates a lot of angst in the marketplace. But so far as why negative ads work, I honestly don't know, but we know that they do. Occasionally there's an opportunity to inspire, or occasionally there's an opportunity to galvanize folks around a positive message. But that seems to be the exception rather than the rule with respect to how we go about this business. And it's frustrating. And I think, it's a problem. It's a nut that we all look to crack, because I think while we all like to win, most of us would rather win with messages that are bring people together and are positive. And, ultimately, I think if you look at sort of the candidates who win, they typically tend to be more inclusive, more positive sort of messages. I mean, even if you look at President Obama or Mitt Romney or John McCain, I mean, typically, it's not the haters, for lack of a better term, that emerge as sort of the candidates that the public.
Yeah, sort of, and Dave, it's an interesting point because I think you're right with all three of those candidates. Although President Obama's messaging in the Romney race was almost entirely negative. I mean, they just ripped the heck out of Romney, but it didn't rub off on President Obama. And is that just his disposition? Is it what he does in public appearances? Is it Oprah? Like what? Like going on the shows? Like how does he stay protected from that?
That's a good question. I think it's probably that he has a very solid base. I mean, you know, not unlike Hillary Clinton, who, while is taking a beating among sort of independents and Republicans and whatnot, she still actually managed to have a very strong sort of standing with Democrats. And, you know, once you lock in a base, it's very hard sort of to pry them away from a candidate. Or certain candidates, at any rate, and that's honestly the only way that I could think to explain it.
Yeah.
I think a big part of it is human nature. I mean, when you know someone, or you feel like you know someone, then you're less willing to believe what someone you don't know says about them, right? But like Romney was largely undefined when he was running, and he's making attacks against someone that who had been president for 4 years and, like Dave said, did have a strong base. So, and then the reverse was when Obama was attacking him, it was like, well, we don't really know anything about this guy. And if you have a cynical view of politicians to begin with, it's like, oh, I had to know, something had to be wrong with him. Of course, you know, he's funneling all that money overseas and, you know, putting the dog on top of the roof and every other crazy thing they said about him. But it's like... You know, a lot of times, if the candidates are known already and they have an existing base of support in their district, negative ads can backfire as well. And so every race is different, and you have to look at both the brand of each of the candidates and the outside circumstances in the race.
And I guess the end result of that is fewer and fewer people voting. Jessica Proud, I know you were the spokeswoman for Joe Lotus' campaign for mayor in New York last time. What was the I can't remember the turnout numbers in that race, but you know, Bill de Blasio won that Democratic primary with like 5% of the vote, 4%. What was that? Do you remember the numbers?
I don't. The general election only, I think, 24% of voters voted in the general, and I think it was even lower in the Democratic primary. I don't recall the exact number, but yeah, I mean, the percentage of people deciding the election to begin with is increasingly shrinking. And in that race, I mean, you had so many candidates, but really Quinn as the front runner, they started running negative ads against her, the New York class animal rights people, and she just started dropping, and then it allowed like someone like a Bill de Blasio to come in, and it was really an amazing thing to watch at the time.
And the Republican side, it's worse. I remember doing a statewide Senate a U.S. Senate race in New York, and it was a 7% turnout, which I think is about average. And people wonder why messages sound the way they do. They're targeted to an extremely small audience that has very strong feelings, which is why you get, you know, messaging on the hard left and the hard right. I mean, you're talking to just a few people. Was it like that, David, when you started? We started about the same time. We're about the same age, but it seemed like the electorate was a lot bigger. You could have a much more general conversation.
Well, and I think it kind of reflects our earlier conversation too. They only got their messages through a very small number of outlets, right? So we were only on radio and on select radio and on network TV. So, you know, when I got into the business, you know, you really couldn't afford to do that narrow, niche sort of push that might be a little bit harder toward your more extreme ends of the party, because you would marginalize the rest of the voters that you'd need. And typically you'd find that kind of more conservative or more liberal voices being heard only in mail, right?
Yep.
I mean, that's where you go and target, and broadcast and radio would be more of a general appeal. Now with the advent of, I mean, you know, for example, with Republicans, all the Republicans basically reside in Fox News, right? And so, you know, when you have campaigns on the Republican side, conservative side, we're all rushing to try to advertise and, you know, spend our money to get our messages onto Fox News. And, you know, that's the sort of channels that have kind of developed and have kind of created sort of, more, I want to say extreme, but yeah, more divergent messaging, right?
Yeah. You know, it's been a long time since the water cooler conversation was, did you see the story in the paper today? You know, it's a whole different world today. Right. I got to say, Dave Catalfamo from Park Strategies and Jessica Proud from the November team. I'm Bill O'Reilly. It's been great filling in for Yitzhak Saflis here on Mind Your Business on 77 WABC. Everyone have a great week.
WABC Radio presents Mind Your Business, hosted by founder and president of Bottom Line Marketing Group, Yitzhak Saflis. Mind Your Business focuses on business and marketing strategies for success. Tune in every Sunday night from 11 until 12 for this intriguing weekly radio show that's chock full of business insights and marketing strategies that will help you get ahead of the game. Host Yitzhak Saflis has been producing pioneering and creative marketing work for over two decades. He leads a team of marketing experts who help their clients build their brands and grow their businesses. Now, he and his guests offer their business and marketing expertise to you every Sunday night from 11 until midnight on Mind Your Business.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.